Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him. Yeah, no.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Now then, welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown, the podcast that looks at the stats, XG and performance of Celtic FC. Celtic are now four games without a win, the first time that has happened since the year 2000. With seven wins from 20 games, it really has been an abysmal couple of months. Before we get stuck into the games against the unbeatable Livingston, we made a group decision not to discuss Neil Lennon's press conference from last week. The less said about that, the better. And instead, we're going to let the football pass the judgment on him. And the last two performances can say a lot more than we ever could. Juco James and Alan Morrison, hello.
Howdy.
Hello, hello.
So, unbeatable Livingston, 10 games unbeaten in the league. And Celtic just cannot seem to get the better of that damn Livingston. 0-0 against Celtic in Celtic Park. Pretty dismal display. Just watching that, I was banging my head off the wall. It was really, really like impossibly bad to describe.
I think that's fair. I would struggle to refute that with any data, I'll be honest with you. And listen, you know, some people might think, why are you talking about the 0-0? It was a very different set of circumstances, a very different team, etc. But I think it's important to really be honest with ourselves about where Celtic are at the moment. And, you know, also in adversity is really where you do earn your money as a coach, as a manager, in terms of how did Celtic deal with the adversity of losing all those players. Something I don't have a lot of sympathy with, obviously, because of the circumstances, but also because, end of the day, the team that was on that pitch and the players that were available are vastly superior to the resources of a club like Livingston and virtually all the rest of the league as well. So, you know, Celtic should have been able to put up a decent showing in that game. But yeah, Livingston, what an enigma, right? I mean, they got an ex-con manager. I mean, that guy, he did serious time for serious crime, by the way. And, you know, he got into football as a volunteer. He's never managed a professional club in his life and is now unbeaten. And fielded two completely different teams against Celtic using completely different systems. And although James will cover the 2-2 game from last night, but absolutely got the better of Celtic in the 0-0 game. I mean, just the bold expected goals. You know, I think it was 0.79 to Celtic versus 1.2, so a differential of just over 0.4 in Livingston's favour for that 0-0. Now, to put that into context, if you look at last season, when obviously Celtic won the league, Celtic's average expected goals for and against in home games in the SPFL was over 3 goals for and 0.64 against. That differential of 2.4 is massive. But that's the standard that Celtic normally, you know, last season hit against all SPFL opposition. And a variance of 2.4 in expected goals is actually, you know, in most cases enough to mitigate against odd things happening, like a sending off or a dodgy penalty decision or what have you. With a 2.4 expected goals differential, you're going to win pretty much nearly all your games. So to go from that kind of differential to we're actually, the differential this season is actually just about one. But now, you know, to go to a minus against a team like Livingston is in itself poor. But really, if you look at some of the other sort of stats from the game. And just the extent to which Livingston were allowed to play exactly the way that they wanted to play, which, you know, those of us probably not Ender, but those of us that are old enough to remember, you know, the Harry Bassett Wimbledon team from the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, they won the Cup in 88. Dennis Wise, Vinnie Jones, Sanchez and Eric Young and all those kind of guys. That's pretty much how Wimbledon played, to be honest. It's you know, get into positions on the field where you can launch balls into the box, and then you'd really see what happens, right? And if you're imposing yourself physically, then, you know, you've got a chance. They had 21 touches in the box. Only Lille and Sparta have had higher than that in any game Celtic have played this season. Yeah, they actually had 10 passes into the danger zone. The danger zone being that corridor from the goal out to the edge of the penalty box, which is a good place to have the ball to get into scoring opportunities. 10 passes into the danger zone is the highest any club has achieved against Celtic. They won 69 aerial challenges. Now, remember, their front three was no more than 5'6", right? We weren't playing against John Fashanu here or even Lyndon Dykes. You were playing against Scott Robinson. And I'll come on to Scott Robinson in a minute, because to compare Robinson's performance as a midfielder playing as a striker with Rogic's performance as a midfielder playing as a striker is pretty telling. So with a front three who, you know, very similar in stature to Celtic's front three in terms of physicality and size, they managed to absolutely impose themselves on the game. Scott Robinson actually won a header in the 6-yard box from a set play. I mean, that's ridiculous. He's literally 5'6". So they didn't do this through obviously silky football, right? They completed, I think, 26 pack passes, taking players out of the game. Fourth lowest of any game this season. They weren't bothered. They were just lumping the ball forward. They gave away 120 passes. They just wanted to, basically, they wanted to, you know, get themselves into a position where Celtic were forced to clear the ball out, and they could then get a throw in. And then the lad on the left, especially, what was his name, Leo DiCaprio, they had the guy with a ponytail, was just launching balls into the box. And actually, you know, they had, what was it now? I'm just struggling to see the number of throw-ins they had. 37 throw-in passes is 10 more than any other team has achieved, and most of those were in Celtic's half. So they absolutely imposed themselves on Celtic. Celtic cleared the ball 42 times. Now, you might think clearances is like, what a boring stat that is. Clearances, what does that tell you? In this context, it tells you quite a lot. A clearance, to me, is a proxy for you're putting a team under pressure. You're putting a team under pressure, they're not passing the ball out from the back. They're just lumping it out, right? It's not a, and I'm going to try and find you. It's literally, I've got the ball and I'm just hoofing it just to get it out the danger zone. That's generally that's how I would, you know, classify a clearance, and that's how I judge it. Average for Celtic last season would have been 16 clearances a game. This season it's gone up to 20, 42 clearances. And that what that shows is two things. One is the amount of pressure that Livingston were applying to the Celtic back line, the high press. And then the second is, you know, Celtic's inability to play out from the back and to actually resist that pressure and actually break that initial line and get the ball into McGregor and Turnbull, who the only control Celtic ever had in that game was when McGregor and Turnbull were on the ball. So, but the other thing that it highlights, and this is the sort of last thing I want to come on to, is just the sheer physical desire of the Livingston team to press Celtic, the physical effort they were putting in. Robinson, right? He got absolutely smashed by Duffy time and time again. Every aerial ball that went to Robinson, he not only did he lose the header, he got absolutely smashed physically. And he kept going up for it every time, because what was happening was every time Duffy went up for the ball, Robinson would lose the challenge, obviously, and take a hit. But he caused enough disruption that the second ball was just a mess. Could have gone anywhere, right? Contrast that with Rogic. Rogic literally didn't even jump for the ball. He doesn't jump for the ball. He didn't make any physical effort to put into the challenge. Now, okay, you're not a good header of the ball, but you're 6'2". You can mess players up. You can back into them. You can get your elbow into their ribs. You can make it uncomfortable with them so that the second ball, you might have a chance of winning, and then you play from there. That's what they were doing. These little guys that they had were just messing people up and just through sheer physical endeavour. And the counterpoint I'm going to come on to is I just didn't see that physical endeavour from Celtic. I mean, Johnson is just, you know, his head went down the first time he got whacked. You know, Rogic just doesn't, you know, the second time he got whacked, his face, he just didn't want to be there. His body language is appalling. And Frimpong, you know, really struggled to impose himself on the game as well. Those front three just couldn't impose themselves in the same way that these very limited players, technically, that Livingston have got, were able to do. And I'm kind of straying into the cliche about, oh, they wanted it more, they put in more effort, which I kind of hate, because show me the stats, right? But what I'm trying to show here is that the circumstantial evidence and the secondary data does tend to lead you into that direction. Now, if we had the GPS data and the running stats and meters covered and an intensity of sprints, I'm pretty sure it would show that as well, because that's what the eye, I think, told us.
Yeah.
Go on, Ender.
No, I don't want to look at that GPS data.
The point I'm trying to make is I'm very nervous about, and I don't want to get into these cliches about, oh, they wanted it more, because this is about analyzing performance in I think a better way than that, in actually looking at data. But as I say, the circumstantial and the secondary data all points in that direction, and I don't care that it was a depleted squad. That is unacceptable.
So, Alan, as you were going through the clearances data, it struck me of the irony of the narrative that part of the reasons that we needed to sign Duffy was to be able to handle, you know, physical strikers, like, let's call it a Dykes. And you know, that was derived largely from the performances versus Livingston last season. And then the Kabamba episode against Kilmarnock with Julian. And the irony of this is Duffy finally got a game where his skill set actually suited, where Livingston dominated us and bombarded our box. I mean, it's just incredible that everything you just recited there, and I don't want to steal your thunder. You'd made a comment on Twitter and before we started here about it's almost like a Ross County opponent. That was really the level of Celtic's output in that game. Was almost like Livy was playing Ross County.
I had so much doom and gloom to impart there, James. You're absolutely right for reminding me that if you look back at Livingston's recent run, okay, of games, this unbeaten run that they've gone on, and you look at the expected goals data and you look at the shot data, this was actually one of the most one-sided games that they've had in that run. The numbers were akin to when they beat Ross County 3-1. That's what I meant by that. The expected goals and the number of shots generated for and against was pretty much what happened when they beat Ross County 3-1. We may as well have been watching Livingston play a bottom-of-the-table team.
Yeah, well, so my tongue-in-cheek comment is that we had a clean sheet because of Duffy against Livingston. So that's
it was worth it, wasn't it?
the whole ordeal this season's worth it.
But actually, he did win a lot of challenges because he was up against a guy that was 5'6". But what then happened is the other aspect of his play was shown into sharp relief, which is his distribution.
Oh, of course.
He gave away 11 passes for a centre-back. That's ridiculous. Centre-back should be around 95-96% pass completion, not 75%, right?
Yeah, it was a mixed. We'll call it a mixed performance from Shane Duffy and at Celtic 0-0. Let's move on to the 2-2 away to Livingston in the snow. Kieran Brown got the first goal for Livingston before El Yunusi equalised from a corner, and then Callum McGregor with a lovely assist for Nir Beaton, but Nir Beaton was about 5 yards offside. No, that's being dramatic. He was at least a yard and a half offside. And then Emmanuel Thomas scored the equaliser for Livingston before the end of the game after Scott Brown's red card. So one thing that I know that you want to touch on here, James, and one thing that we should touch on is where Celtic were playing most of their football in this game. Because one thing Neil Lennon said after the game was that we work the ball into good areas during the game. So is that true? Is that necessarily true, what he said?
I don't think so. So I haven't, honestly, given the timeline here, I haven't had a chance to rewatch the game. And to be honest, I don't think I'm going to rewatch that one. It was too brutal. So I don't rewatch every single game. I'll probably pick out some cuts and take a look. But maybe on the YouTube version of the show here, Enda might throw up a couple of these heat maps. But one of the observations I've had for some time under Lennon, and it's I actually wanted to query Alan on this. So one of the things I've noticed is we've just lacked central presence. I mean, you talk about that danger corridor from the goal line out to the 18, kind of encapsulated inside the 6 yard box lines. What I like to do is extend that out all the way to the midfield circle and think about, you know, how much possession do we have centrally in that corridor? And why Scout had the system as 4-4-2 diamond, I don't think it was. I mean, when I look at the heat maps, it looks like it was a four kind of, you know, again, I speculated before the game, it might be a 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1 or a mess. And I think it was a mess. when I look at the heat maps, there's no central presence, even, and one of the heat maps I shared with you guys that we can maybe put up was Turnbull's performance against Hamilton, at Hamilton. So again, another plastic pitch in the 3-0 on, I think it was Boxing Day. And he had a lot of central presence outside of the 18, kind of roaming as you would think a number 10 would. And regardless of whether it was 4-4-2 diamond or let's call it 4-2-3-1, if he's the nominal number 10, his heat map from this game, he's nowhere near central locations. He's kind of wide right, wide left. Christie and Elyounoussi were more like wingers. They were wide. McGregor was way out wide left. It's almost like some of the same problems that we had when we were tilted left, where the ball would all go outside to Taylor, earlier in the season. And the thing that to me is pretty remarkable. I mean, I monitor this, pretty regularly, and it might be confirmation bias because I focus in on it, through Brown's playing period the last couple of seasons, but it's been typical that Brown would be open centrally and the center backs or the fullbacks don't play him in. And, from a risk-reward perspective, that might be a smart decision because, usually Brown doesn't do much with the ball centrally other than just kind of pass it sideways or back again. Soro's not that. And, when I watch Soro move to get open into space, he's pretty regularly, in space where if you play him in, he can do something, either beat someone on the dribble, distribute the ball, not backwards. And I think, his passes received centrally. I think he only had 5 forward passes yesterday. And I think he only had 2 or 3, what Alan would call pack passes or progressive passes. So when we've seen the diamond work, we've had a lot of central presence. We've had midfielders and Soro dominating the ball centrally, and possession centrally. And then that's leading to, better scoring opportunities. And, as we a derivation of that is XG. And yesterday was like a reversion where we had almost no possession centrally. Everything was out on the wings. And again, if you think about, Griffiths is not the striker to be lumping crosses into for the most part. And I thought his performance was pretty awful. Shocker, 10 days off and Lee Griffiths isn't necessarily at peak form coming into the game. So, again, from a system perspective, I couldn't make sense of what we were trying to do once again, which, again, isn't shocking based off of what Alan talked about in the 0-0, where, and that's really been the stress test of Celtic this season has been anytime, things kind of go wrong or we need tweaks tactically or to do something responsive when things aren't working. I didn't see any of that again yesterday. And again, the subs were just unbelievable.
So just coming on the tactical side, James, I think, again, credit has to be given to the nine game manager here. The way he'd set up Livingston, he had 3 very narrow centre backs. And then it looked like it was going to be it said at the beginning 3-5-2, but it wasn't. They had Hamilton up front, and then the 2 wide players, who was Emmanuel Thomas, who got to be one of the worst footballers I've ever seen in my life. And Greg Taylor was like, I've finally got an opponent up against me who's way slower than I am. I've got to have a field day today. But anyway, they had Emmanuel and Thomas and Forrest were giving them a sort of wide presence. But when they lost the ball, those 2 players kind of filtered back. And it became a 3-6 because they actually had 4 quite tight in the middle. So I think credit to Martindale, who would have probably have guessed that Celtic would have gone back to the diamond with the squad now being more intact, and he basically packed that midfield. But I agree with you in terms of the Celtic shape wasn't obvious. It wasn't obviously set up to be that diamond. Christie was really wide, and he never really came in. And McGregor was fairly wide. And therefore, like you say, there wasn't that connectivity, the ability to play those quick, sharp passes, which having those six skillful players in physically close proximity, the diamond gives you that. Because El Yunusi was wandering. Griffiths, positionally, he tends to drift as well. Didn't have that central focal point. And the midfielders weren't as connected as they have been when that diamond has previously been implemented. Well, but I think some of that's down to how Livingston, sorry, was set up.
I agree with that, and I understand. This is where, again, my relative naivete is such things. This is why I wanted to query you on it, Alan, is, you know, just fundamentally and conceptually, you know, that was a really a reserve Livingston side to a degree. I mean, he dropped seven players in advance of their cup semifinal this weekend. So the idea that a Livingston reserve team, regardless of how they set up, would be dictating play to us, you know, this was not our reserve team, right? I agree with you in the nil-nil game that even shouldn't happen in that game. and they did dictate play to us in that game. But the reality of them forcing us out of our quote-unquote game under any circumstances, to me, is mystifying. And to the point where, again, if I look at, you know, one of the pieces of data I like to look at, particularly with those forward players and the central players, is how many times they lose possession in a game. And, you know, in a game against, let's say, you know, Rangers in December 29th last year, where, you know, they played narrow and we had real trouble and we kept trying to play centrally, but we kept losing possession. That's reflected in the data. Like we were, you know, bashing our head against the wall, trying to force things and not, you know, achieving it. That was not the case yesterday. I mean, our lost possession stats, somebody like Turnbull, you know, we weren't losing possession, trying things centrally, is my point. So we basically
El Yunusi, sorry.
Well, yeah, right, to a degree, and he's the only player other than Griffiths, and Griffiths was largely a ghost. I mean, he hardly touched the ball in open play. El Yunusi was the only one that had some central presence. If you look at his heat maps, yeah. It wasn't a lot, but it was, yeah, you know, kind of the same area that he usually gets into, which has always been the issue with him and Edouard in that kind of, you know, left half space outside the 18.
Yeah.
So
I've done 20 minutes of the game in terms of capturing data, so not representative of the whole game, obviously. But what struck me about El Yunusi was, you know, some of his real key attributes were in real obvious in the sense of, you know, he's combative. Him and Christie have got the best challenge win rates amongst all the midfielders apart from the defensive ones. So that was in evidence. And he was available. He was open, right? He was available for forward passes. It's just that when he got the ball, he just gave it away. You know, in 20 minutes, he'd given the ball away in the final third six times. Yeah. You know, and then you know, he had that moment when Griffiths was open and he just had to shuffle it left to Griffiths. Literally, you know, just not dwell on it, and he kind of, you know, butchered that opportunity as well. So it's such a mixed bag. You know, he's combative, he gets into great positions, his movement's good, he's open.
Incredible finisher. That goal was an amazing finish.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. But he's Anthony Stokes level decision making on the ball sometimes in the final third is just gives it away so many times.
Yeah, and I did a video a couple of days ago basically following on from James's comment about the clear out that Celtic need to do, and I essentially took out all the players who would be probably leaving at the end of the year and went over the skeleton of what we have. We still had four number 10s at the end of this year if we make a decision, if we sell players. And we definitely don't seem to be playing to those strengths. We still, even against a team like Livingston, who were set up that the only way or the best way to approach the game is getting the ball out wide and stretching them as much as you can. But even in the games that we're not playing against Livingston, when teams are there for the taking in the midfield, we still don't play through the centre even though we have the best number 10s in the league?
Well, I would disagree. I think, you know, that run of games where we introduced that diamond, we did actually see that. Because not only did we see that in terms of the connectivity between, you know, McGregor, Turnbull, Christie, Edouard, I would say is a proxy 10 as well. These are four players who all know how to play number 10. And they were connecting and we were winning the games and we weren't conceding chances either, because we had control and we had solidity. Mm-hmm. So even if play broke down, that diamond shape is pretty solid in the middle. So you could break wide, but you weren't going to break through the centre, which is most dangerous. So I think Lennon was right to persist with it. But like, I think to James's point, one of the persisting themes we keep coming back to, and we talk about the same things every week because of it, is this failure to react. If things aren't going well, how do you change it? The simple thing that occurred to me on the 0-0 game was that, you know, midway through the first half, when Rogic had failed to hold the ball up and given it away for the fifth time under challenge, I'd be thinking, do you know what? 10 minutes, Turnbull, Rogic, just swap, right? Rogic, you play your natural game. Turnbull, you've got a good first touch. You're 6 foot. Just try it for 10 minutes. What harm is it going to do? It can't be any worse. Something might happen. At least try it, right? Just something. When it's going bad, you've got it. Every game. No, who makes the first sub? Not Celtic. You know, the momentum's gone. We haven't completed a pass for 10 minutes. We haven't had a shot for 20. Do we change it? No. Let's wait another five. That theme is there, and it was evident in both games actually.
Defensively in this game, obviously conceding two goals is disappointing. Again, another set piece. Christopher Ayer this time switching off and not picking up his man at the far post. Couldn't have been an easier finish for him in the end, really. It was a header from like 6 yards out or just the penalty spot. So, and he had a clear open goal to do it. James, what was the defensive performance like? In terms of the data, was it as bad as it looked?
Yeah. So actually, from a defensive performance perspective, I mean, we from a chance creation perspective, Livingston didn't really do anything from open play other than the second goal. And that was based off of, you know, I think it was Christie that missed a tackle and let the guy, kind of have a free walk. I think it was, I'll call him Hippie Boy. You were calling him DiCaprio. I think his name is Brown. And he played a good game. I mean, he scored and then he had that cross. I mean, we made him look like, a world beater. But yeah, I think their XG was sub 0.5. So, you know, again, as far as benchmarking home games, as Alan had said, that's a decent level of suppression of chance creation. And, you know, with only one of them really coming from open play of significance, that's not too bad. So, you know, it was kind of your point, and it's a free header from 6 yards is, you know, from a free kick from just inside the midway line, the halfway line. I mean, that's just an incredible ineptitude.
40 yards that ball traveled.
Yeah.
Pretty much in a straight line. I mean, it's just, it's literally schoolboy stuff. It is, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, credit to their Brown. I mean, you know, it was a good header. And then it was a good finish by Alan's favorite player.
The Jet, good old Jet. A player,
but that's, you know, this comes back to what Alan was saying about, you know, that 2.4 differential in XG at home last season, and that being wide enough to kind of be resilient and robust to variance. And so, you know, this is an example where you had a team with not a lot of chances score two goals. And you know, I would argue in a season long, you know, I've said this so many times, I'm a broken record this season. As a one-off, yesterday wasn't horrific. You know, to have a 1.2 XG differential and get a draw at Livingston, given their form, where they're at in the league table, you know, we weren't going to go 38-0 this season, most likely. With no draws. So in the grand scheme of things, yesterday's, you know, as a one-off, is not, you know, a horrific development. It's contextually, given everything else, that's where, you know, the things stack up and pile up, and it's a confirmation bias thing where you just say, you know, because we've given up so many free kicks this season, and you know, this was a horrific one where Iyer just let a guy go. You know, you're going to give up goals in the season. You're going to have games against inferior opponents where they don't create a lot of chances and score a couple of goals.
Yeah, but those individual mistakes, like you say, will happen. Tom Boyd made an interesting point on the Celtic TV commentary. He said that, you know, in his day before they changed the offside interpretation, you would literally drop off the player that you were marking just as the ball came in. So you give yourself that moment, that millisecond to react to whatever happened. You can't do that now because they can stand offside and then come onto an onside position. So it makes it a more confusing picture. And I get that. If you actually watch the goal carefully, Brown has got himself between Iyer and El Yunissi on the back post. And Brown actually, Iyer, makes a gesture to El Yunissi. And I don't know whether he's telling El Yunissi to pick Brown up or not. But given the number amount of traffic in front of Iyer, I would have thought it would have been Iyer's job to pick up one of the three centre-backs, really. Yunissi, whatever Iyer said to him, did nothing.
Well, there's no language excuse there. They're both Norwegian, so we're not...
Well, there you go. Good point. Iyer has his back to Brown as the ball comes in. Now, we can stress every single goal, and I'm just pointing that out because, you know, that you can look at it to that detail if you want to. But I come back to if individual players make mistakes throughout a season, you sort of go, well, that has happened. That's football. That happens. It's normal. But when it happens every single game, every single week, and it happens multiple times during a game, that's not individual players. Okay, that's a fundamental failure to have a system and a communication protocol and a framework that everyone understands and knows their jobs. It's fundamental.
Yeah. I'm going to steal your thunder here and raise a topic. You may have it next as a bullet point, but the substitutions then were just incredible. You know, the idea of, you know, we really needed a goal, and to take Iyer off and leave Duffy on. I mean, I could get the theory of bringing Frimpong on, but the fact that it was Iyer that came off and not Duffy, and again, I don't have any problem with bringing Soro off. And this comes back to a conversation that Alan and I have had for ages, which is, you know, when we're against inferior teams, I still don't necessarily even think there's a requirement to have a quote unquote Soro in the game, meaning that, you know, that shielding defensive midfielder, particularly when we're chasing a goal. So to then double that down and to have an inferior shielding midfielder come on for your shielding midfielder, and why you don't drop McGregor into that role and put on a more attacking player as an, you know, whether it's Henderson, whether it's, you know, obviously in Cham rumored to be the player out with COVID potentially. That doesn't make any sense to me. I get there's an argument from the start of the game as to whether you want to take that risk. And I think there's, you know, reason for room for honest debate on that, but particularly away at Livingston versus home. But, you know, within that context of having, what, 15 minutes to go or 12 minutes to go or whatever it was, and needing a goal to make those subs that way, I just, wow.
Well, Iyer actually had a pretty good chance in the first half as well, and it shows you he makes those bursting runs into the box. Shane Duffy doesn't, and Iyer has the ability football wise to take those chances. He didn't on that occasion. I know Stephen Kenneth on Twitter did get in touch with us talking about the subs, and he was in agreement. They were just baffling from the night before. One thing on your point about Soro, I completely agree, because if you think about the way Livingston play, they're not playing through the center. You don't need that cover there. And what you can do is you can replace Soro, like you're saying, with a ball-playing midfielder, and you can drag them out of position by playing the ball through the middle. That's how you get your advantage in midfield, not by spreading the ball wide. If that's not working, you put a ball-playing midfielder into the middle and you play little triangles, drag them inwards, then you go outwards and they're out of position. It's really basic stuff. It really is. And it's baffling to me that nobody has seen this. Or if they're seeing it, they're not acting on it.
There's a piece to, I know I keep promising to do this now, and I will do it, around the analysis of substitutions, you know, from a statistical perspective in terms of the timing and the impact, because Sky Sports flashed up that stat last night about Celtic have scored 10 goals from substitutes this season. And immediately everyone will go, well, Celtic are really effective at making substitutions, which is such a bad use of data, right? And it's akin to me of flashing up this, flashing up the data that says, you know, the goalkeeper for Sheffield United has made 10 saves in a game. Yeah. It's like, you know, yeah.
Can I play
for the worst team? Right?
Can I just interrupt you there, Alan? Because I've been in the production room for a TV production of a football match for Champions League, and literally what that is Celtic are making a sub. It's 80 minutes in. The director of the football says to the producer, we need to find out how many goals Celtic have scored from substitutions. Yep. The researcher who's getting paid £10 an hour to be there is frantically searching on Transfer Market or wherever search engine they use.
It's not them
analysing it at all. It is just them, we need to find this out really quickly.
But the more serious point is, like, number one, Celtic, even this season, score more goals than every other team. So they're going to have more goals from subs. Number two, they've probably got the better subs than any other team this season. What I want to look at is to what extent, you know, substitutions change or don't change games. And the methodology, I think, probably needs some thought. But what I'm thinking is, you know, what was the kind of XG pattern before the substitution? What was it after? What was there, or what was the chance creation pattern before and after? Did that substitution actually make a positive or negative change? Because in my notes that I take when I'm watching these games the second time, I've noted so many times where, And this is what I used to do when I was in grassroots football and the teams that have helped out as well, is one of the value adds I feel I gave was what I could sense when, I guess you'd call it, when momentum had swung, or when things maybe slowed down, when things had gone quiet, when passes, you weren't breaking lines anymore, or it just looked like there was a couple of weaknesses appearing defensively and things were perhaps turning and you hadn't been in trouble before, but now you're looking like you might be. Rodgers, actually, I think his assistant Davis was fantastic at this. They could almost see a problem before it had materialised into a real issue, and they dealt with it by making changes. We don't do that, and it's absolutely glaring to me. But I need to find a way to statistically show that, because I'm absolutely sure it's the case.
Well, when you do that piece, we will absolutely talk about that instead of talking about Celtic drawing with Livingston two games in a row, because that's vastly more interesting. It does make me sad when I watch the Premier League now and Brendan Rodgers is coaching Leicester to the top of the table for, albeit, a night and a half, and then Kieran Tierney's already slotted in to be the best left back in the league. It's completely jealousy, but what can you do?
The end of the serious point to that as well is that it does show you the quality of players Celtic have. You know, your McGregors, your Forrests, your Nchams, your Edwards, they're all of that kind of standard.
Listen, even Stuart Armstrong, who I would have considered not the best midfielder in that Celtic team that he played in, and he's starting for Southampton, are doing brilliant this year as well. So it's all about coaching and how well that is happening. Well, that's what makes it more blatantly obvious to me.
As pretend hobbyists in the analytics community, I wanted to give a shout out to Jack Lyons, who was name dropped by Madison in his interview after the Leicester game. He was the former analyst at Celtic that Rodgers brought in. So, you know, some pride for the Scottish analytics community and making it to the top level as well. And just for the record, Jack stayed at the club for the full season. He didn't leave with with Rodgers in February. So, you know, some pride for another Celtic supporter getting to the top level.
And listen, James, there's a serious point there as well, because a couple of people who have been in touch on YouTube or in the comments on Twitter who don't believe in the data analytics and don't believe that it's you watch football with your eyes, that's what happens. This is modern football. The analytics side is as important as a lot of things these days, and James Maddison showed it there, because he was a footballer who didn't really understand what he had to do to score more goals. And they had a coaching ticket smart enough there and an analytics team smart enough there that they were able to say, right, if you do this and we will get players into a different position, you will score more goals. And it came to fruition. Yeah, that's exactly how valuable this thing is.
Well, and one of the buzz stories this week in the analytics community was Man City has a dedicated arm in research and development for all of their clubs. I forget how many they have under their umbrella, but they hired one of the prominent academics in the space who from Harvard, who's an astrophysicist. So, you know, the level of intellectual firepower that's being thrown at this space from the biggest clubs is remarkable. And, you know, all the way down through, you know, analytically, meaning that obviously he's controlling things and building an infrastructure. But that research and development and the analytics that's then permeating down through the coaching staff, the players, I mean, that's the level of competition that Celtic and, you know, Scottish clubs in general are going to face increasingly within a European football context. And, you know, former players or, you know, guys that have their A badge or whatever badge you might have, that's a different animal. You know, coaching's important. You know, there's different domains of expertise and skill sets here. That's not a theoretical physicist or an astrophysicist. those are different fish. So it's an important area to consider when we keep talking about this analytics space, as far as the level of resources and firepower that clubs are throwing at this.
Hamilton up next week. Is there anything you just want to touch on before we finish up?
To be endured.
Yeah, you know, it's. I do. The only other thing I want to come back to is I don't. You know, the selection on the striker side has continued to vex me, and it even vexed me last season when they went to Edward and Griffiths. And I had a thesis, and I kind of stand by it at this point, that a lot of Griffith's output was a derivative of the system and the quality of opponent last season, meaning that I still am uncertain that that's some great partnership between Edward and Griffiths, more so that we're getting a better structure against inferior opponents. And, you know, when Edward's firing and you have McGregor firing as an attacking eight. And the other thing that's missing that was there last season, which was the creativity of Ncham as an attacking eight over Christie. When you have that network effect, I think that really put Griffiths in a position to have a lot of output, which he did to his credit in that environment. But that he hasn't been as productive when he's played this year. He's been okay. And I just wonder how much of this is due to, you know, again, him being in a good position relative to opponent and the other players he's playing with. Long-winded way of me saying, I'd like to see a Jetty get a run if we keep persisting with this 4-4-2 diamond, and particularly with Edward. You know, that would be my wish list, is to get, you know, some exposure from a Jetty to see, because I think his profile, that's why I was excited when we signed him. I thought his hold-up play and his physical profile of being a box striker, you know, someone that's actually advanced, putting pressure on the center backs. You can play it into feet, and he can, you know, physically battle a center back. I don't even know how many times Griffiths didn't possess the ball. You know, he was tried to play in last night. And again, it was tough pitch, tough circumstances, but, you know, that's not really his game to begin with. So that's, I probably won't see it because I hardly ever get to see what I want. But you know, that would be the one iteration that I'd like to see, assuming that Edward's knee is okay and he plays. Is let's get to see a Jetty paired with him, because I think we've only seen that once this season, which is absolutely remarkable considering that we literally brought this guy in to pair with Edward, nominally in a 3-5-2. But even now that we're in a diamond playing two strikers, and we're just not seeing it. Remarkable.
Yeah, the 3-5-2 actually was successful, but it was almost exclusively used against the weaker teams. It was abandoned for both the Copenhagen games.
Yep.
And the game against the Rangers as well. So it's very difficult to judge it on a comparative basis. It was successful in and of itself in terms of the games that we played it in. But again, context is everything, as we keep saying. And same with whereas the Diamond, you know, was effective against Lille and was effective against in the Derby game as well. It was the decision making and the response to crisis that failed Celtic in that game. Yeah, so I agree with you. I don't know what's going on with the Jetty, but he's had a few 70-minute runouts, but very little of a sort of sustained. You know, putting on Klamala as the first change last night made no sense to me. when you could have put on a Jetty, difficult pitch, physical team, you needed, like you said, absolutely right, you needed presence centrally. That just made no sense.
Mm-hmm. I'm not looking for perfection. I'm just looking for Celtic to play an actual striker as a striker. That's my wish list. I know. Imagine the gall of me to consider that the club should be playing an actual striker in that position. Just a heads up before we finish up that next week's podcast will be going out on the 20 Minute Tim's Patreon page as opposed to the usual places. So if you want to listen to that, we'll be doing a more broader look at the season so far. So if you want to be depressed next week, essentially what I'm saying is listen to the Huddle Breakdown, get involved on the 20 Minute Tim's Patreon page, and we'll be sharing that out across the Huddle Breakdown pages as well. If you haven't yet subscribed to the YouTube channel, we've just hit 1,000 subscribers, so if you have, thanks very much for subscribing to the channel, and thanks to everyone who's listened to the podcast as well so far. We'll chat to you later.